Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 12th of July, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. Back after a short summer break. In fact, probably, judging by the weather at the moment, probably that was it for summer. But anyway, we're back behind our desks after a welcome break, aren't we, Phil?
Yes, very nice indeed. I feel that we ought to spend at least 5 minutes discussing our holidays. Then we are entitled to claim it as a deductible business expense on our tax returns.
Yes, that's very good thinking, Phil. Where did you go?
I was staying in Dubrovnik for a week, which is very nice, a bit expensive these days, but I'd not been there before. And a day trip to Mostar in Bosnia to see the famous bridge. I mean, the whole place got bombed to pretty much smithereens in the war in the early 90s, but they've rebuilt it rather fabulously.
Oh, great.
That's Dubrovnik was bombed as well, and a lot of that's been rebuilt. And a trip into Montenegro as well was very nice. So we did a bit of travelling around. How about you? Where have you been?
I went to Sicily, which was very nice. They'd
see any old rubble?
Directly outside our apartment was the Temple of Apollo. Very old Roman temple, which I have to say I was upbraided by my wife for saying, I think I've just spotted some Roman concrete, because it's a very early Roman temple, these remains. But there were the sort of stumps, the remains of some large columns, which seemed to be made up of a sort of a matrix of concrete with bits of brick in it, and it certainly wasn't stone. So that was very interesting. Well, it wasn't that interesting actually. There are far more interesting things to do when I was there, but I couldn't help noticing it. It took me a while to get out of the work mode, but really nice place, and I would recommend it. Really nice place, Sicily.
Anyway, mission accomplished.
Yes, I think indeed.
Justify those as business trips.
Yes, indeed. Okay, then, down to the real business, Phil. What's been going on since we last spoke?
Well, obviously, lots. It's been a month since we last convened for reconstruction. One of the first things that happened, I think, since we last spoke, well, the last time we spoke, if you remember, we were talking about how Ilka Homes had been put up for sale. That didn't last long. Beginning of July, it went into administration. They couldn't find a buyer. I think they had various people sniffing around going, we're interested, show us your books. And no buyer, into administration, and about 1,000 workers, more than 1,000 workers, employees, out of work. One or two, I think, might have jumped ship quite quickly to Keepmoat, which is Ilka Homes' sister company, effectively. They've got the same owners, and there's always a bit of cross-pollination between Ilka and Keepmoat. But we discussed before about Legal & General closing their factory in Selby area, isn't it? And Ilka are not that far away near Knaresborough. So it's everything we said before times two.
Well, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Rather sad news. Very sobering, in fact, when you consider how important and hopeful the whole sort of off-site sector has been for a while. Yeah, there's been quite a lot of bad news in that sector. Something to watch.
I want to know whether the taxpayer is going to get the money back, which Homes England loaned many millions of pounds to Ilka, I believe.
I imagine the banks are first in queue.
Always away.
Okay. There's been quite a lot happening in the infrastructure sector as well, particularly in terms of roads. In fact, there have been some very interesting manoeuvres in the road sector recently, Phil. Bring us up to speed with some of that.
Well, I think we talked a month or two ago about a High Court challenge that had been launched by a retired scientist, ecologist, environmentalist, Dr. Andrew Boswell, he's got particularly local knowledge. He's a former Norwich City and Norfolk County councillor. And he was challenging, there are various schemes between Peterborough and whatever the port is in Norfolk. But the A47 is being upgraded, dualled in lots and lots of bits in all sorts of different sections. And we talked before how he was challenging the probity of National Highways' environmental impact assessment methodology, because they said, well, this 3 mile stretch here is going to do, you know, generate so much emissions, and this 3 mile stretch is going to do this. And Dr. Boswell's contention is you shouldn't really do that. You should say, no, this is an entire big long route that you're upgrading. You should consider the impact of it in toto, where the sum is greater than the the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
So we're talking about carbon emissions, aren't we? This is what it boils down to.
And I think he's mainly talking about traffic, but of course there are also emissions involved in construction and so on and so forth.
But
what's happened since we last met, just the other day, was that the High Court in London came down on the side of National Highways. More specifically, Dr. Boswell's case was not against National Highways. It was against the Secretary of State for Transport, Grant Shapps. Still Grant Shapps, isn't it, I think?
Yes, I believe so.
Keeps changing. Probably won't be by the time this anyone hears this, the reshuffle thing. Anyway, he was challenging the Grant Shapps granting or signing of the development consent order, which is basically the planning application for big projects.
Yeah.
And he said the development consent order should not have been signed. Shapps was wrong to sign the DCO. That was what the actual case was all about. High Court said, no, Shapps got it right, perfectly fine. It complied with the legislation. And National Highways is going, yay, great, all systems go, we can get on, we'll start building these, specifically three contracts in the waiting to go, which have had their DCOs signed.
Yeah.
They will now stand, and work will start next year, all being well. Except that Dr. Boswell has now decided, well, very, very, very rapidly decided, within about 15 minutes, it seems to me, that he's going to lodge an appeal.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether the appeal will be, not being a legal expert on these processes, I think they have to decide whether the appeal can be heard, and then the appeal will be heard, I think is how it works. So we will see. He was basically saying that the judge who came on the side of Shapps got it wrong, doesn't know their law. It's still a bit up in the air. And the other thing that's interesting about it, these are all three were Galliford Try jobs on this bit of A47, all in the Norwich area. And one of the projects I learned this week is, National Highways told me, Galliford Try is stepping away from. I don't know whose decision it is in particular, but the two stretches of road being widened, I think one's a £90 million stretch and a £250 million stretch, I think, project contracts in that order. And there's aside from that, there's a junction upgrade. They're taking out a roundabout where the A47 meets the A11, two big trunk roads meeting, taking out the roundabout and putting in grade separated junctions with flyovers and what have you. Now that has obviously got more complicated and more expensive than initially envisaged. It was initially estimated at £50 million to £100 million range. And then last year they said actually it's a £160 million contract. So whether it's the fact that the scope of that has increased, they think they need another contractor to come in and do that bit, or whether Galliford Tribe just thought, ooh, that's a bit too much, a bit too rich for us, a bit too much risk. I don't know which way around it is, but that's gone out for tender. So there's an opportunity for someone to get that.
When I read that, I wondered why. Do you think that the cost increase was a result of just sort of inflation? Because costs are going up left, right, and centre, aren't they? Is it simply the fact that the project has been delayed for so long that the price has increased beyond what Galliford Try felt was viable? I mean, had they signed a fixed price?
I didn't ask specifically about that contract because it's been an answer to an earlier question I asked National Highways. I said, these, you know, on your website, all these projects have got a fairly big cost window that, you know, for example, that junction upgrade is initially, in fact, still on the website saying 50 million to 100 million. And I said, well, presumably we can now assume that given inflation since these things have been started knocking around, all these costs are going to be at the upper end of your estimates? And you went, yeah, that's a safe bet. We acknowledge that. So anything that says, you know, whatever, 50 to 90 will be 90, and everything that says 200 to 270 will be 270 or whatever.
Yeah.
But this one, this particular 847A11 junction, the new estimate is so far above the initial estimates, that's more than inflation. That must be change of scope.
But getting back to Dr. Boswell's court case, this is not just an isolated incident. In a way, it is isolated because it's separate. But the whole issue of climate change, sustainability, carbon emissions, and infrastructure, particularly road construction, is an increasingly important issue, isn't it? It's getting more and more high profile. And there was a climate change committee has just published a report, which seems to, if I read the summary correctly, seems to back a lot of what Dr. Boswell's saying, which is quite interesting, seeing as the climate change committee is actually a government agency or government department, part of the government.
It's not actually clear. The climate change committee is not a government department. What it is, it's set, completely separate from government. It has statutory responsibilities. It was created, it was specified, designed by, and I can't remember what piece of legislation, but there's a specific piece of environmental legislation, I want to say 10, 15 years ago, whatever, maybe 20, which said, and, you know, under this act, we will create a climate change committee, which will provide advice to government on climate change issues. Now, I don't think there's anything in the law that says the government has to listen to it or even read its reports, but it'd be wrong to say that if the climate change committee says something, that's what the government thinks.
Right.
It's not a government.
It's an advisory body. Tell us something about this report, because it seems to me as if the government's getting its knickers in a twist, because it's got so many conflicting priorities here. And I think that this report actually highlights a fundamental one, which is that prosperity and economic success is not necessarily compatible with our climate change targets. What's your take on it?
Okay, the wider subject here. I'll do the wider point and then come back to
Okay.
The wider point is that the net zero enthusiasts, I mean, there are two things. One is they would say that the climate crisis is more important than economic growth. I mean, there used to be, you know, 20 years ago that the Green Party would be accused of being anti-growth zealots, and more recently, was it Liz Truss or someone talking about anti-growth,
anti-growth
coalition?
Yeah.
And there's this suggestion that saving the planet means we're going to have to go back to living in caves and not have electricity at all, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other side of that is actually if the UK PLC takes the lead on low carbon technologies and we become the centre of battery powered cars and heat pumps and solar panels and everything, we can export this great technology to the world, and we can build a new economy. I mean, this is very much sort of the Boris Johnson rah-rah.
Yeah, the green economy.
We'll build a new England, New Britain on the back of this green economy. Only trouble is everything we've tried so far has flopped. Because look at the Teesside battery plant, which is belly up. We're not leading. We import everything still. I think there's a little bit of lithium mining in Cornwall, but basically it's not. And powering the green economy is the vision to be able to have growth. But yeah, going back to your specific point about roads, the tension between those people who want to go see Gran or ship goods overseas, import goods from overseas, get from port to port or city to city, do business, who rely on moving themselves or things around the place, there is support for roads, there's support for HS2. I mean, traditionally, most people considered transport investment. I mean, there are arguments about but specific areas of the M25, but could you imagine not having the M25? Hell on earth as it is to drive on, but without it, like, you know, it would be unconscionable to live in the southeast. So, I mean, to my mind, clearly we need infrastructure. And I even sort of still support HS2 on that basis, but I, as I said, now that it doesn't go to Leeds, I'm a bit softer on it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the climate change committee have come out on the basically anti-road. To cut to the chase of it, they said that the there's a quote which I posted. The Welsh government accepted the recommendations of its independent roads review, which included cancelling 31 of 48 road projects that were reviewed and reconsidering a further six on environmental grounds, and they introduced stringent tests that will only permit new road projects if they meaningfully contribute to modal shift. And they say, the Climate Change Committee says, that's a good thing. Well done, Wales. England should follow suit, basically. England should look at that. Now, if we only build roads, I'm trying to understand this. How can you build a road that contributes to modal shift?
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you say...
Modal shift is getting off roads and onto rail or some other, or a donkey or something like that.
I think if you get out of your car and get on a National Express coach, I think that counts as a modal shift.
Okay.
Maybe what they're saying is we should build roads which only allow coaches on them, maybe.
or roads which only
allow electric bikes or walkers. And I struggle with this idea of only allowing roads which encourage, contribute to modal shift, which get people out of cars. And yeah, you know, I get the argument that we build more roads, it just makes more traffic and it makes the problem worse. And this is the old, what's that old transport body that Michael Palin used to be involved in? Transport 2000. Transport 2000 argument that building roads just makes more traffic. I get that. I don't support it absolutely, but I get the point of it. So anyway, the Climate Change Committee, which, let's not forget, is chaired by a former Tory cabinet minister, John Gummer.
Yeah. Lord Devon, or Devon, as he's now known.
Devon is now known as, but he's still John Gummer. He's always been a bit of a...
He was environment secretary, wasn't he?
I think he was briefly, famously, he was the agriculture secretary.
That's
at the time,
right,
of the PSC
fed,
friend.
Yes.
And
fed his daughter
a burger. A photo op, force-feeding daughter Cordelia a burger.
That's right.
He's always been on the greener end of the the greenest end of the Conservative Party.
Yes.
Well. But it's interesting that it is not some, you know, radical activist group saying that road building should be rethought and halted. It's what it does do, of course, is gives any government a get out of jail free card, as we've talked about before, to stop spending money on road building projects.
Yeah.
So they can say, well, it's not our fault. You know, it's a climate crisis. We can't spend money on road building.
No, exactly. I mean, I said that that they were getting their knickers in a twist. And by that, I meant that really it's very difficult to reconcile all these priorities. How can you build a road that doesn't have cars and vans and lorries driving up and down it? That's a cycle track or a footpath. You know, how can you justify building a road on an environmental basis? Because the problem, as I see it, is that roads carry traffic, and the majority of vehicles which travel on our roads at the moment emit carbon dioxide and various other pollutants and particles.
Even those that don't emit have got huge amounts of embedded carbon in them, so don't get it.
Indeed.
I'm not saying you should, but battery car drivers shouldn't get all preachy about their battery powered cars.
No, indeed. So to me, it seems as if a road is fundamentally at odds with our climate change targets. So what do you do? Just stop building them all together? Of course, you can't do that. So presumably, the government needs to find a fudge somewhere.
Well, a popular measure that governments have tried before is tax fuel. So that to such great heights that no one can afford it and no one can get anywhere. But of course that is a regressive economic measure because it's not, because people are, fuel has proven itself to be enormously, or demand for fuel has proven to be enormously elastic. People will pay whatever it damn well costs. But it means they've got less money to spend on other things. But if it did reduce fuel consumption, it would harm the economy because economic activity depends on mobility, regardless of all this working from home business.
Yeah.
Even aside from Zoom and email and whatever, mobility is an economic motor.
Yeah. You made the point in your coverage of this Climate Change Committee report that, you know, some major road projects such as the Lower Thames Crossing and the Stonehenge Tunnel basically wouldn't pass muster, so they would be scrapped automatically if the Climate Change Committee's recommendations were adopted. So that again is a difficult decision that somebody has to make. But you also ran another story, which I thought was quite interesting, about the Lower Thames Crossing. And your mention of fuel is what alerted me to this, because there's been National Highways has decided to go green on the construction of this project, hasn't it?
Well, they've always said, or they've been saying for a while, because there's been so much argument about the environmental impact of the Lower Thames Crossing, National Highways always say, right, we'll make it the damnedest, greenest road and tunnel that mankind has ever seen. It's going to be so green you won't believe it. It's going to be a carbon positive, and it's going to be absolutely fantastic. But what they came out with just this week said that it's going to be the first major UK infrastructure project to use hydrogen to power its plant. Mm-hmm. And the actual press release they put out saying that they're launching hydrogen for the Lower Thames Crossing. And I thought, what does that even mean? I'm sorry, you know, it sounds very interesting and great, but what do you mean? It says, oh, we've published a tender notice, or it might even be a prior information notice. I think it's a tender notice, seeking a contractor to supply hydrogen to the Lower Thames Crossing scheme. And National Highways will pay for someone to produce, deliver and store on site hydrogen for use by the contractors on the project to fuel their plant.
Right.
So what they do, and the Construction Leadership Council came out with something, a route map, I think is the term, for how construction machinery, the decarbonisation, the move to battery power and hydrogen, and I don't think they mentioned solar power, but I mean, you have sort of a digger with a little windmill on top blowing around that gets it forward, propels it forward. I mean, whatever. But the whatever new thing comes up that doesn't involve fossil fuels, everyone's all for it. The trouble is no one quite knows what's going to be Betamax and what's going to be VHS.
Yeah. But to what, when they say that they're going to use hydrogen, I mean, to what extent are they going to use hydrogen? Is it going to be a token few diggers, or are they going to go 100% and ban diesel throughout?
The aspiration is there will be no diesel. The aspiration is that the small stuff and the tower, I imagine the tower cranes are electrically operated.
Yes.
Will there be tower cranes? There might be some tower cranes moving things around.
There might be,
tower crane project, is it? But stuff that's currently electrically powered and battery driven, that will still be there. But there are the bigger machinery, your diggers and your trucks, which there have been a little bit of battery power at the edges, but it doesn't really work because they're too heavy.
Yes.
Moving towards hydrogen power. And that's what, basically the earth moving machinery and the ADTs that carry the spoil away, they will be hydrogen fueled.
I mean, I know that a lot of manufacturers have been developing.
Sorry, just for clarity on that, we're not talking about hydrogen fuel cells, I think, here. We're talking about the liquid stuff that you put in the tank.
Yeah, I mean, I know that a lot of manufacturers have been experimenting with hydrogen. You know, JCB is very prominently in favour of hydrogen, have been doing a lot of work there. But others have as well. As I understood it, hydrogen as a fuel, rather than, you know, distinct from fuel cells, it has to be mixed with an oil. So presumably if it isn't diesel, it'll have to be HVO, which opens another bucket of worms. So I just don't think that really the technology is there in order to do this, unless they expect the project to be delayed by another 10 years so that the technology can catch up. How much do you know about this? Is it likely that they could field an entire fleet of hydrogen-powered excavators and dump trucks?
As you well know, David, when it comes to science, you're in the top stream and I'm in the remedial class.
Well, I'm not sure about that. Well, anyway, I mean, I don't
what
know.
I do know is that if it does take 10 years for hydrogen to develop properly for as a fuel for mainstream construction machinery, as far as the Lower Thames Crossing matters, that may be a moot point. I mean, they still hope, they reckon, National Highways reckons, that they will start shifting Earth, if not boring the tunnel, in 2026.
Okay.
I simply do not buy it. That is hopeful. You know, it could happen. The planning inspectorate has only just last month begun looking at the development consent application. Mm. So to start in 2026, I think is hopeful at best.
Yeah. Well, it's a very contentious project. So I suspect that there's a certain amount of environmental window dressing going on here. As usual, it's a laudable aspiration, but I'm a bit suspicious that it'll actually come to that. I can't imagine that a project of this size, due to start by 2026, is going to be hydrogen powered. Yeah, I think there'll be hydrogen involved, but not 100%.
Well, there's already hydrogen involvement in HS2. And
yeah,
it would be easy for a cynical old journalist like yourself, David, to say, oh, it is greenwashing, it's window dressing. They're pretending that, you know, same with HS2. They're pretending because they're using some battery powered machines and hydrogen that HS2 is not actually carving swathes of damage through the country, and Lower Thames Crossing isn't a hideously environmentally damaging project. Whereas I, being an optimistic, outward-looking person, would say, isn't it good that our big government national infrastructure projects are pioneering innovation and promoting industrial development and technological revolution for the sake of green technology?
Setting
and
an example.
Climate?
Yeah, okay, yeah, all right, then that's a valid point. Yeah, I suppose inevitably people are going to talk these things up, and maybe the reality won't be quite as impressive as the publicity has led us to believe. But yeah, all right.
Can I take my tongue out of my cheek now?
Yeah, why not? So that's that. Also, didn't you speak to somebody at the Institution of Civil Engineers about this Climate Change Committee project? What's their take on it?
Well, the Institution of Civil Engineers, they put out a press notice. I think even before anyone had seen the report, certainly before I'd seen the report from the Climate Change Committee, which the takeaway from what they're saying is, we're full square behind the Climate Change Committee. We agree with everything they're saying. They're great. They're fantastic. So I wrote the story saying, Institution of Civil Engineers agrees that road projects should be scrapped.
Yeah.
Knowing that that would wind them up. And it's quickly, I'm saying, what? We never said that. And I said, well, I thought you supported the Climate Change Committee and everything they're saying. I said, yeah, but not that bit. I'm sure we'll return to those with...
I'm sure we will.
Exciting regularity. Yeah, now, I was away last week, David, and you stood in for me on our daily news service online, and you covered one of my favourite topics. It's the annual report of UK Export Finance.
That's right.
Talk through it.
UK Export Finance, which is, it's the operating name of the Export Credit Guarantee Department of the government. It basically underwrites projects which are, you know, basically exporting British technology and products overseas to help developing countries mainly. And they published their annual report.
Can I just flesh it out? Sorry to interrupt.
Yes, of course.
The original rationale is that when big British construction, Balfour Beatty, wins a contract to build a dam in some dark, undemocratic republic somewhere in South America or whatever, and it says, well, this is a really good job. If we get paid, it'll be brilliant, but we might not get paid. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that the British government underwrites it. It's insurance in case they don't get paid, is what it is. Yeah, it's an insurance scheme.
And the idea lots of governments do that. I mean, we're not the only ones, you know.
No. And it's to support. In fact, a lot of British construction historically, I mean, British construction doesn't seem to talk about export credits, UKEF or ECGD as it used to be, so much as it used to. But they used to always complain that the Italian government was much better at supporting its contractors.
Yes.
Let's say ex-Italian Empire countries and British government was supporting British contractors working in ex-British Empire countries.
Yeah.
And therefore, the Italians were winning on the world stage in construction.
Yeah.
But British contractors don't really operate on the world stage. I mean, I know mentioned Balfour Beatty, it's got a joint venture, Gammon in Hong Kong,
exactly,
very successful and established. But it's not, that's not really exporting, it's more of a financial involvement. But anyway, so... I'm interrupting.
Well, no. Anyway, so the top of the story, the basic story is that UKEF, UK Export Finance, has published its annual report, and it says that it provided £6.5 billion in new direct support to UK exporters in 2022/23. So basically, it's helping to boost British exports overseas. They reckon that it provided loans, guarantees, and insurance policies which supported up to 55,000 jobs in the UK and added £4.1 billion in gross value added to the UK economy.
Up to.
Which is great stuff.
So, what is up to? up to 55,000.
Anything jobs. Between zero and 4.1 billion, yeah. Okay. no, but anyway, so what other figures is it said? It said 1.1 billion was provided to construction exporters, which is good, supporting 5,000 jobs in the sector, 25% more than last year. So, right. Yeah, we should be grateful for that as well.
I'm going to leap in here.
I've
done some further digging on this. As far as I can tell, that 1.1 billion provided to construction exporters has supported two UK jobs.
Mm-hmm. True, yes.
the three contractors, construction companies, use contractors euphemistically here, the three mm-hmm. construction companies that are listed in the annual report of having been given support by UKEF, between them, they employ two people in the UK, according to their most recent annual reports.
This is ASGC UK we're talking about, yeah?
Well, ASGC UK is one of them. Does that have...
That's got two employees.
Yeah, it's got two employees. Yes, that's Al Shaffer. Al Shaffer, yeah, General Contracting.
Yeah.
Dubai company.
Based in Dubai, that's right.
But it's got a London office.
Yeah, with two people in it.
Whose business is to get money out of UKEF, UKEF, Al Shaffer and its clients.
Well, they in fact, you reported this when they first announced it back in January. They, Al Shaffer, ASGC UK, whatever you want to call them. Yeah, they basically got this job building a specialist burns hospital in Angola. And they, the funny thing is that UKEF, were just sort of trumpeting this project to build this, this hospital. UKEF provided £130 million of support for it, you know, underwriting. Anyway, so yeah, they're building this hospital. Of course, ASGC UK isn't building it, but, they're financing it.
No, they're not even financing it. They're just
brokering agent. It.
Yes.
Yeah, they're brokering it. The deal is apparently that, you know, 40% of the effort, I suppose, so contractors, materials providers, goodness knows what else, are from the UK. But we don't know who those people might be. There's just this sort of rather arbitrary 40% British content.
Well, sort of. What they have to be, they have to be... 40% of the project will be fulfilled by suppliers that have a UK registered office. Now, there are all sorts of, just like there are masses of British companies who've got a boilerplate in the Cayman Islands or somewhere for tax purposes. There are companies all over the world who've got a nameplate, in London or in the UK.
Yeah.
And that is a registered office. And I cite Mullard, another company that benefited from UK Export Finance support this year, ACC UK Group Limited.
Mm-hmm.
ACC in this context stands for Arabian Construction Company, and that's based in Abu Dhabi.
Okay,
that's got
that's what it says on the tin.
Its office, in inverted commas, is in the building centre in Store Street.
Okay,
so I did not know
everybody's in Store Street.
Well, I didn't know that the building centre was in this game. I thought it was just where you went to, you know, look at different brick specifications something, or a little display of what architects are up to. But no, apparently they have nameplates of theoretical offices of Middle Eastern construction companies. Now, if ACC has a registered UK office, therefore, if the company who we're talking about, Al Shaffer, you know, for this hospital in Angola puts all work through ACC. That's a British company. Yeah, yeah. It all counts. It might not be a scam, but the annual report of UK Export Finance throws up far more questions than it answers.
Yeah.
And it is high time some parliamentary committee looked at it. Now, the broad defence for UK Export Finance is we are profitable. We make money.
Yeah.
Well, because it's a casino. Casinos always make money. They're the house in the insurance business. But by that basis, why don't we just nationalise Legal & General and Admiral and all the other insurance companies and have done with it? As a taxpayer, I just don't think it's the business that we should be in. If it's you know, Balfour Beatty or Keir, who need proper support because they've got taking on a big project in some risky country, fair play, let's bat for Britain. But I don't understand why we're giving £1 billion, £1.1 billion of support to companies who've got basically no UK employees, no UK presence, and it's a scam. It's not a scam. It's a scandal.
No. Yeah, yes, it's a scandal. Yeah, you're quite right. No, it seems ridiculous. I mean,
up to 5,000 jobs, my arse.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. There doesn't seem to be any sort of hard information. I mean, where do they get that figure from? You know, 5,000 jobs. They don't provide any evidence to support these things.
Someone has done a study that every £1 billion you spend on construction in the UK supports 5,000 jobs, I imagine. So they're going, oh, well, £1 billion means 5,000 jobs.
Yes.
So in this, I don't know, Oxford Economics or CEBR document that, you know, Civil Engineering Contracts Association have put out, therefore we'll use that because it make it official. No, it's, I mean, I'd say bollocks. Well, our producer.
Of course you are.
Tom has a habit of cutting out, Tom's a producer, people, and he has a habit of cutting out our colourful language.
Yeah.
But it's bollocks.
Well, it is bollocks, yeah. Yeah. And, we're just talking about construction. Obviously, the UKEF underwrites all sorts of other enterprises, UK domiciled, well, UK registered enterprises in different sectors. So I wonder if it's exactly the same in, say, retail or manufacturing or energy or agriculture.
If you look at the annual report of UK Export Finance, it does show all the people who they supported, whether it's loans or guarantees or whatever. And plenty of genuine British companies there. And the one that struck me is Wood Group. Although, I've got to be honest, didn't they change ownership recently? I don't know if Wood is which is a big sort of offshore or oil and gassy engineering
contracting company. Right.
And I recall some sort of change of ownership there. But even if it is foreign owned now, it is, you know. It's a bit like, you know, Skanska or BAM in the UK. I mean, it is basically, as far as I'm concerned, a British company. No problem for me there. So there are proper British companies being supported by UK Export Finance, just not in construction.
Not in construction, no. Should we move on to our last topic of the day, which is a very curious topic, if I might say. Something you ran a story about this earlier in the week about Big Brother, basically, and I'm not talking about the television series.
This is a couple of weeks ago. This is end of June.
Oh, was it? Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
This is how long since it is since we've been talking, though.
Yeah.
Go on, tell us. You run.
Okay. Right. Fine. Yeah. This is a tech company called Utopi. Not Utopia, but Utopi. There's an obvious
almost
connection.
It's
there.
Almost it's Utopia. Almost,
it's almost Utopia. But I would, as I read this and I looked into it further, I thought they ought to rename themselves a Dystopi. Because there's something really a bit creepy about this. This is a company, Utopi Technology. Private rented sector developer and operator Downing is fitting high-tech sensors to monitor residents in its developments. The Utopi Technology, which has also been adopted by Modal Living, is like a smart meter on steroids. This is your language, Phil, but you're absolutely right. It monitors not just energy usage, but also air quality and noise, and I think other things as well, motion. It also monitors motion. So there are these units, they just sort of sit on the wall, I suppose, or dangle from the ceiling, that collects real-time data for light, noise, air quality, temperature, humidity, and motion. And provides the the social housing provider, the landlord, with vital well-being data, and helps them to create happy, healthy communities. And the thing which I think, it gets a bit dark the more you read about this. I mean, I watched a promotional video on their website that this device helps to educate and support residents through information and incentives, and it will improve individual behaviours.
How much more Chinese can we get? Yeah. Eh? We will educate you to improve your behaviour.
Yeah. Yeah, really weird. I mean, of course, again, we get back to this theme of net zero and environmental improvement and all the rest of it. It's sold as a way of helping you, the landlord, to help your tenants to reduce their carbon emissions and
their bills.
Make a meaningful contribution towards our 2050 net zero target. But I don't know what the incentives are. I think there's mention of a sort of, you can compete to see who's the greenest of residents.
If you're the tenant of this block of flats, if you're the resident who wears the thickest jumpers and turns the heating on the leak and eats only cold baked beans out of a tin that's been opened manually, not by electric tin opener, and you don't put on your television or charge your phone, and you use no electricity or energy, you can win points like 10% off your bill. I didn't specify that, but the idea is your service provider will reward you there's an app that the landlord has which monitors who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in your building, and then there's an app that the residents, the tenants, have which have their wellness score. It tells them how well they're doing saving the planet. Now, the two things that you might say, well, people have smart meters already. It's exactly the same. What's wrong with this? Mm. And the other thing is, I remember the first time I had a car which had a fuel efficiency gauge on it. And as you started revving the engine, this sort of bar would go across, saying, "Oh, you're or go down, I should say, going, oh, you're only going to do 15 miles a gallon driving it, or a litre or whatever, driving it at that speed, matey." And so, and it did. I found myself with this car, not, changing gear from third to fourth, for example, much sooner than I used to, and really trying to keep that fuel efficiency bar as high as possible the whole time. And that changed my driver behavior, and that saved me money. Mm-hmm. And this app is sort of like that in concept.
Yes. Yeah.
The difference is, with my car, it's basically between, me, the engine, and the petrol pump. But with this almost utopian technology, it's your landlord spying on you.
Yes. Yes, and you're in competition with your neighbours, aren't you, to see who's the greenest.
That as well, the gaming of it. I mean, it is so Black Mirror, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is. I've only just discovered Black Mirror. It's been going for years, TV series. I was introduced to it by my youngest daughter only this weekend, funnily enough, and I watched a couple of episodes, and it gave me... It didn't give me nightmares, but it disturbed my sleep. It was horrible. So maybe my perception of what utopia is up to has been somewhat coloured by some of the awful things depicted on this television series, which is all about how technology and social engineering.
That is why Black Mirror is so good, because what it's showing you, there was one not terribly long ago, I think it was shortly before we had Uber in this country and Airbnb, young people, you go through life trying to get likes and clicks, and you're staring at your phone trying to get likes and clicks, and if you don't get the likes and clicks, no one will talk to you, and you're not allowed into the office or this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, it's ridiculous, Uber and Airbnb, because everyone's, oh, they're fantastic, they were great, you're great, you're great, you're great. Because if you don't do that, you can't get an Uber, and no one will let you into their Airbnb.
Yeah.
So anyway, Charlie Brooker did one on that concept before at least Airbnb and Uber had become quite what they have become since. And
sure.
He's only ever, to be fair, I was going to say he's one beat ahead of technology. He's actually one beat behind technology, but ahead of where most of us realise we're at.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we should point out that Utopia is not alone here. It is one of a myriad technology companies that are producing devices and systems for the social rented sector. I mean, I'm very much in favour of social housing. I think it's very good, and I think it was what happened to council housing over the last few decades is appalling. But
Downing, hang on, Downing and Modi are not socialists. This is private rented sector we're talking
this
about.
This is the private, yes. This is private rented sector. But I mean, housing associations are also investing in this sort of technology. In fact, I wrote a piece in the March issue of the magazine about this. There's an organisation called Procurement for Housing, which has launched a framework. A procurement framework called SHED, which is Social Housing Emerging Disruptors. In fact, this is the second SHED framework, which is currently underway. And I didn't mention many of the systems which are available on this. Basically, a lot of these organizations, I don't know how big Utopia is, but a lot of these tech companies are relatively small startups. And they've got incredibly clever technology, which has useful applications to the housing sector. And the problem is, of course, that they're small companies. They don't have the resources to promote their product necessarily. So a framework like this helps them to actually get a foot in the door. And so a lot of them have, and some of the technology is very clever. A lot of it is very similar to the Utopia thing. For example, there's one called Rubix, spelled Rubix, which developed a cloud-based housing management software system that looks after everything from occupancy and planned maintenance to health and safety compliance, finance and document management. Very obviously very useful for a landlord. The most curious one was, which I didn't actually go into in any detail, just mentioned it at the end of the article because it seems so strange, which is, this again is very Black Mirror. It's an app called Hello Lamp Post, and it's an interactive text messaging service that gathers views by asking residents to chat with street furniture. Basically, and there was a photograph of a man holding his smartphone up to a sign fixed to a lamppost saying, "I'm here to chat. Text Hello Lamp Post number 9. And basically, you can give... You can give your feedback about what's going on in your community, what's wrong, what's right, and etc., etc. You don't have to talk
grass
to your
neighbours, presumably.
Yeah, well, yeah, you don't have to talk to your neighbours. You can talk to the street furniture about your neighbours. So there's a lot of very clever and perhaps slightly worrying tech out there, which is disrupting, to use the current terminology, the housing sector, the private rental, and the social rented sector. So yeah, Utopia gave me the heebie-jeebies when I read about that. It's probably not as bad as I imagine it is. I'm still reeling from Charlie Brooker's dystopian fiction, but it certainly seems to fit that bill.
It could help drive demand for new build housing. People want buy their own property rather than if living in the rented sector means you're being snooped on and spied on and you know, watching how much you eat and how warm you keep and so on and so forth. Yeah, I'd want to move out pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, but as you point out, Phil, you know, people are already installing smart meters, and energy companies are encouraging people to do that so that we can see how much energy, so that they can see as well how much energy they are consuming and how they can possibly reduce it. There are technologies which are available to all of us, you know, homeowners as well as people in the rented sector, to monitor and manage energy usage and make sure that we're good citizens and, you know, aren't polluting the atmosphere and burning up too much energy. I mean, I feel terribly guilty about living in a 100-year-old home with largely single glazed windows, and that I'm wasting all this energy, heating it in the winter and destroying the planet and doing untold damage for future generations. So I feel guilty already without the technology.
But by putting the problem right, you'll burn more carbon, you'll emit more carbon than if you do nothing over the next whatever. Let's say you've got another 50 years left if you're super lucky and you take the right drugs.
Well, yeah, I certainly haven't, I can tell you that.
I was trying to be nice, David. But, you know, if, we've talked about this before, the payback is for fixing up an old house or for making it, you know. Okay, there's some things you do easily. Insulating, easy win. Yeah, Getting double glazing put in throughout, that's...
easy, but expensive.
Expensive, but a lot of carbon in there as well.
Yeah,
the glass
sure,
manufacturing process, and, you know, what's going to happen to stuff you take out, it's going to go...
Yeah.
Wooden frames might be burnt, but the glass probably at a landfill, or I don't know, probably not recycled.
I mean, we often talk about... I mean, we're going off on a bit of a tangent here. We talk about embodied carbon in the built environment when people talk about, the carbon savings. And we talk about the embodied carbon, which is the carbon emitted into the environment through the production of the materials or the construction of the building or structure.
Exactly.
Rather than... what is emitted by that building or structure in operation. You look at something like a wind turbine or a solar farm, there's an awful lot of embedded carbon in there. I suppose the argument is that that's a one-off. You know, you've emitted that carbon in the production of that technology, that structure, that building, and then it pays it back over a period of however long, and beyond that period you're actually carbon negative, I suppose you'd argue.
But doing nothing is often the greenest thing to do. If you've got an old polluting car, which you don't drive it very often, you do 5,000 miles a year, and you think, oh, I better get a nice new clean one, well, you're buying a nice new clean car which has got embedded carbon in it,
sure,
still some but not so bad emissions. And the old thing, which you're only 5,000 miles a year, is going to be scrapped and crunched and whatever's going to go through. The saving might not be greater than the cost of the transaction of dumping the old car and building a new one.
Yeah. How many people make that calculation, and how reliable is that calculation? You know.
Well, that's the actual, that's, I take your point. However, I often take the calculation in general terms that it's best just to do nothing.
Yeah.
Green may have nothing to do with that calculation.
It's a very comforting thought, Phil. Do nothing.
It may be related to cleaning dishes.
Yeah, it could be.
Or hoovering the floor. It's probably better to do nothing.
Do nothing and bask in your smugness.
Yeah. We can justify it.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do for the rest of the day, actually.
Save energy, David. Save energy.
Yes, I will. So I suppose, having said that, we ought to turn our computers off and say goodbye and go for a long walk.
Get some vitamin D.
Yes, indeed.
Yep. Good plan.
Okay, so are we done, Phil?
I think we are. I'd like to say thank you to our regular listeners, and thank you to you who are listening. I can't remember your name. You did tell me your name, but you're listening for the first time today.
Yes.
And it's great to hear you listening to us.
Yeah, we know who you are. We know who you are.
But tell your friends all about us that we're here. We'll be back as usual on our fortnightly cycle.
Yeah.
We've had our summer holidays done and dusted. Looking forward to autumn, and then it'll be Christmas. But for now, thank you very much. From David and I, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.